CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 75, with Dr. Daryl White, the most important lessons of the past many decades. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest, my good friend and colleague, Dr. Daryl White. I've seen his name before. He used to run a very nice podcast about eye care and ophthalmology. I love his writing. He's probably the best writer in ophthalmology. There's no way he did a science background. He must have done like an English major. But anyway, we'll get into it. It's a fascinating conversation. I know you'll really enjoy. Daryl, welcome to our podcast.
Uday, thanks so much. This is a real honor, a real treat. I'm just absolutely blown away by the work that you've been doing over the last several years. The Cataract Coach videos are just killer. It's totally rocking it. And this podcast has been a blast. And, you know, before we really get going, it's about damn time you made it to the power list. You've been moving markets and moving the educational needle for years. So, you know, congrats on that. And you know, thanks for this.
Well, I'm honored. Thank you. I actually made the power list last year, but not this year.
So who knows? Dick Lindstrom doesn't make it some years. So, you know, what can we say about it?
So, I mean, the crazy part there is that, you know, listen, it's a popularity contest. And even since high school, I've never won those. But the best part is I just get to be me. I get to, like you, just let me just enjoy life.
Yeah, and the wonderful thing about being where we are in our careers is that we get to do just exactly that. It's been such a privilege to be an ophthalmologist, to be an eye surgeon for so long, and to still have a chance to share some of my thoughts. I'm sure you feel the same way. We have some things to say, and you know we're not really on the glide path yet, but maybe on our radar we can see the airport, and so it's really a privilege to be able to have it and to be able to do it with you. That's awesome.
Well, you're right. When we're in our 30s and we're starting off in our careers as ophthalmologists, it can be a bit of a grind. You're working incredibly hard, sometimes not really seeing the fruits of your labor, but I tell you, mid career. It's beautiful. It's wow. Yeah. It's everything I dreamed it'd be. So for the young ophthalmologists who listen to our podcast, and I know we skew kind of young, I know it's the grind. We all ground really hard, worked really hard in our 30s, but ophthalmology, I'm thankful like you every day that I'm an ophthalmologist.
Yeah. Remember when we met? This is a really funny thing, and you may not remember, but there was one of the original BMC events was at Dana Point, and it was a B&L event. And I met you and Mitch Jackson on the same day.
That's pretty intense.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. I'm going to get him on the podcast too, for sure.
That'll
be 20 years.
Oh, yeah. It's a little more than 20 years. I think it was the early 2000s. And it was, boy, Adam and David were just launching their business. And who else was there? Brendan Scheel. I mean, talk about what a trio to meet for the first time at the same event. And you and I have, we have found ways to connect again and again and again for 20 plus years. It's been a great run. It's been a blast having this friendship.
A blessing for me too. And, you know, one of the best things in ophthalmology, especially the meetings, is just connecting with good friends and colleagues over the years. And the crazy part is, there you are in Ohio, here I am in California, and yet we just connect, and it's amazing.
Yeah, I was there when I woke up this morning. We wake up at our house at dog o'clock, and I know that you have dogs. I don't know if you have the same thing, but we have two Australian shepherds, and they are just convinced that the day starts at 6 o'clock, regardless of what's going on. And I'm off today, and so dog o'clock came really early this morning. But I was thinking, you know, you offered a really reasonable time for me here in East Coast time. What the heck are you doing up that early in California?
So, yeah, for people who are wondering, we're recording our podcast. It's 8:30 East Coast time, 5:30 a.m. Pacific time for me. I just wake up early. I like to sleep early. I wake up at 4:30. I like to get a lot of things done in the day. And so, for me, I'm most productive in the mornings. Even when I operate in my surgery center, I leave home at 4:45, get there at 5:15. I start cutting by 5:45 in the morning, but then I'm done by 12 or 1 p.m. I'm done. Go home at noon or 1 o'clock.
Yeah, I can't, since I don't own my own surgery center, I'm beholden to other people's schedules. And, you know, it's a typical 7:30 start for me. And I'm typically done by noon or one as well. The folks who work with me have been incredibly kind and incredibly loyal, and so they, you know, they do work hard for me, and I'm sure they do for you. But which brings up an interesting thing. You know, we've both been private practitioners for our entire careers, and that landscape has changed, hasn't it? You know, when we first started, it was like 75% of ophthalmologists were in what you and I would consider traditional private practice. And it's what, 32% now or something like that?
It's dropped dramatically. But, you know, all of medicine's changed. So I did, since I finished my training in 2000, so the last 24 years I've done private practice on my own. But I've also did for 22 years, I did academics part-time. So from 2000 to 2022. And like 2 years ago, I retired, or you know, from the academic world. Now I'm only doing my private practice. But you're right, completely different. It was 75% private practitioners, and we actually got paid, gosh, double what we're getting paid in year $2,000.
So now I finished my training in 1990, and we were paid at that time for cataracts. It was $1,800 a case when I first came out in practice, which, you know, you could reasonably say was higher than, you know, the true value. And I wouldn't
argue. No way. It's worth way more than $1,800.
You know, so now, you know, it's crazy. It's some ridiculously low number. I think it's 569 or something like that, without taking into account inflation. It's the economics are just absolutely crazy. But as you alluded to in the beginning of our podcast, the benefits of being in private practice, I don't think have really changed. I think things have changed around it. You know, being captains of our own ship, even though, you know, you have to take on some of the administrative stuff, but being the captain of my own ship has allowed me, even when I was in the, you know, the grinding years, those, you know, the first 15 or 20 years of practice, you know, you had an opportunity to chart your own course.
Right. I mean, that's having the autonomy is so critically important. Now, it's good to be your own boss. My only problem is sometimes my boss, who's me, is a little too tough. But other than that.
Yeah, we've both had interesting evolutions that have gone right along with that. We've never practiced together. We've never practiced in the same area. But it's been fascinating for me, who, and I've kind of moved in and out of things that are around our practice. And you've done the same thing. We've had priorities that have come from family. We've had priorities that have come from our outside interests. I love the sound of my own voice. And so any opportunity to talk to people has always been fun. And I found my voice at the keyboard at a certain point. But the ability to choose when and where we've moved in and out, I think, has been priceless.
Yeah, for sure. Being a captain of your own ship, as you put it, really is key. But, you know, I like hearing your voice, too. You've got a great intonation. But more importantly, you're super eloquent. And even the way you write, let's talk about that for a minute. The way you write, I love to read everything you write. Now, how are you so good at writing? I write like a biology major.
So, interestingly, Uday, I am a biology major, but I went to one of those colleges that demands that everybody learn how to write well. I went to one of those small Northeastern liberal arts schools, and it doesn't matter really what you major in. Everybody's expected to write adequately. But I'm the son and grandson of English teachers, and the dinner table at the White House when I was growing up was just a fascinating free-for-all, where not only were you expected to be able to, you know, were you expected to state your opinions, but you had to back your opinions up. And heaven forbid you not speak properly while you were backing them up. And so, you know, those folks who know me kind of offline, I guess, know that I basically write the way I speak. And it's what's the best way to put this? I think while I'm typing, and since I can't type as fast as I think, it allows the thoughts to be more adequately and accurately distilled once they get on paper. If I just dictated it, you know, dictation software is fabulous now. But if I dictated it, when I dictated, I find that the eventual end product quality is not quite as good. And so type, even though I type 70 words a minute, so it's not like I'm a hunt and pecker, but still it's much slower than I actually think.
Interesting.
Yeah. The writing thing has been good. I started writing years and years ago. I started writing for CrossFit. I had a long, really fun engagement with the CrossFit community and with CrossFit Inc. starting in 2005. Mm-hmm. And in 2007, I started writing for CrossFit every Sunday. That's where Sunday Musings comes from. And every Sunday, I would write something for the CrossFit community. And I had my own blog, which I basically wrote just to empty my brain. You're a guy who's had an amazing number of really, really good ideas. And, you know, Cataract Coach has allowed you to get a lot of them out.
Sure.
And, you know, what I did with my blog was I just kind of emptied my internal hard drive, I guess is the best way to put it, because when there was stuff in banging around inside, there didn't seem to be enough room for new stuff to come in.
Right. And
putting it on my blog, getting it out, allowed me to kind of leave it behind and leave room for new stuff. So that's where the writing comes from. And I've been very fortunate that people have discovered it and they've enjoyed it.
We love that you absolutely speak your mind. You just let us know your process when you literally are typing your mind. But the best part is you say things that we're all thinking, but sometimes we don't put together in our heads until we read it and we say, yeah, that's actually right.
It's one of the other things about being in private practice is that I don't have a boss who's looking over my shoulder for things like that. Although, you know, the CFO of our corporation is really my boss, my wife, Beth. And those of you who know Beth, know that she's universally talked about as D. White's better 95%, because, you know, calling her my better half really cheats her.
That's too funny.
But, the other thing is that not being part of a big institution, I don't have to give consideration to the big institution's position on anything. And we've seen in the last several years how folks who felt passionately about anything were somewhat reined in if they were part of a university or a big group. And I don't have those limitations. No. I sort of have the permission to tell the truth, I guess is the best way to put it. And in addition to being the son and grandson of English teachers, I'm the son and grandson of parents and grandparents who always emphasize that the first prerogative should always be kindness. And so even though I'm telling the truth, I'm trying to make sure that I'm doing it from a place of kindness. So if you've done something good, if you've done something really well or something important, I'm going to look for opportunities to tell the world about that. I'm going to say your name and I'm going to say it again and again and again. I talk about Cataract Coach all the time today when I'm talking to young ophthalmologists. If you want to go to one repository of the best of what the developments have been over the last however many years in cataract surgery, you got to start at Cataract Coach. And then I say, it's Uday Devgan who did it. If, on the other hand, you've done something bad, you've done something stupid, you've done something which you really was not in the best interest of anybody, I'm going to talk about it, but I'm not going to say your name. And I'm going to couch it in a way that there's no way for you or anybody to know that I'm actually talking about you. Because
kindness and tact.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, if you're a fan of real literature, which my stuff isn't, you see that a lot of what people think of as true literature is written from a very personal place where the author names. Mm-hmm. And it's often family. I'm not going to write about my family that way. I'm not going to write about my friends that way. You know, you look at Hemingway. I mean, Hemingway's best friends were the subjects of his early novels. The dude ended up alone because he kept writing about the secrets of his friends. And you're not going to get that from me.
Well, we appreciate that, because I've done as many dumb things as I have smart things. Yeah. I'm pretty sure I'm zero sum at this point.
Yeah, perhaps we all are. But it's, you know, the writing is fun. I was very fortunate. Somebody sent one of my personal pieces to Dave Mullen at Ocular Surgery News years and years ago and said, hey, you know, you guys are always talking about looking for writers. Maybe this is a guy you want to look at. And so Dave looked at a few of my personal things and then called me up and said, hey, listen, you know, would you like to do a blog on dry eye? And my response, of course, was sure. I've been giving the editors, the poor editors at Helio, agita for a very long time. I think it was 2009. Uh-huh. And I don't know why the other invitations came. You know, after a short time, he said, hey, you know, the blog's doing pretty well. Do you want to do a monthly column? And my initial response was, haven't you been reading my stuff? I'm getting all kinds of feedback from the editors, and they're a little, you know, they're a little anxious. And you want to give me another one? He says, yeah, sure, go ahead. And then a couple of years later, same thing happened. He said, hey, you know, we're thinking about doing a podcast, which I need to get back to today. I've really been remiss. And you want to do a podcast? And my response again was, haven't you been reading my stuff?
Well, you don't pull, to be clear, yeah, you don't pull any punches. You speak from the heart, which that's why you connect with someone like me when I read it. Like, wow, I love this guy.
You know, it's, and again, we have some things in common here. Way back when I was just a punk kid out of residency in my early 30s, one of the very first things I noticed was that all of the pharmaceutical companies, all the medical device companies, were missing a key information pipeline. They were getting tons of information from really important ophthalmologists in academia, mm-hmm. But they really weren't getting a whole lot of information from people like you and me, people who mostly just went to work, people who went and sat in back of a slit lamp, people who went and sat at a microscope. And so they really didn't have any sense of how we used their stuff. They didn't have any sense about how we were prescribing their medications. For example, I said to one CEO, I must have been 35 or 36. I was quite convinced that I was brilliant. And, you know, time will tell if I was right. But and I said, listen, have you noticed in your sales the percentage of sales that come from the full professor of practicing glaucoma at XYZ institution versus the country doctors like me out in the village taking care of the peasants? You know, it's like 95% us and 5% them.
Right.
Did you ever think about asking us how we're using your stuff or what you're doing? And, you know, thinking about somebody like you in the operating room, you know, back when you were in your mid 30s, you know, did anyone think about asking Uday Devgan, how might the aspiration pressure curve work better? Because you're wonky like that. I'm not. I listen to you and then I make people think it was my idea, but it's yours. And then that started really kind of a behind the scenes crusade that I'm still on right now. I think that the people who help us on the industry side, who are very important, we can't do what we do without them. Their job is better and the stuff that they come out with is better if they listen to the people who are in the trenches, the people who don't talk on podiums, the people who don't write for periodicals, the people who don't have a world famous podcast. If in some way, shape or form, either one of us can represent those folks, and I've tried very hard to do that in the things that I've done behind the scenes, but it's always seemed to me that our world would be better if there was input from the working man, the working woman who goes to work and just sees patients and goes to the operating room and just operates. They don't write papers. They don't do anything because that's where the majority of the work gets done.
Yeah, it's also changed though. From the podium, you know, early when I spoke on the podium, the company would say, well, why don't you speak on the podium about, like, choose a topic, like aspheric eye wells, help ophthalmologists understand that, explain what our product is, and then give me a few, like, background bits of data or a few slides, but I would put together an entire slide deck on my own. Then it morphed into like, you can't do that. You have to use this corporate slide deck. But then if they ask you questions, you can answer them, even if it's, you know, off label or something else, you can answer any question. But then it became no. And now it's super strict. You can only present these exact slides from the podium, which have been cleared by our company, our legal department. You can't answer any questions that don't relate to the slide. And you can't say anything off label. It's like, God, that's just not reality. So as a result, I don't do that anymore. I don't speak for these companies anymore. It's not worth it.
So there are some of the things that I really like to do. First of all, I agree with you entirely. I don't disagree with a single thing that you just shared. There are, by the way, one of my my doggo clock alarm clocks just came in for a pet here.
It's okay. We love dogs.
She's being registered. Have you shown your dogs, by the way, just as an aside, on any of the video things you do?
They've been there a couple times.
Oh my goodness, they're beautiful dogs, but they're closer in size to my wife's horses than they are to my Australian shepherds. So, I still do some talks that are best described the way you just described it, because in some ways it's the table stake. The membership fee, I guess, is a good way to put it, in order to be able to sit down with a vice president of sales or a vice president of marketing or the chief medical officer and chat with them about what I see happening out in the real world. And again, you know, I love the sound of my own voice. And so, you know, anytime that I can talk about stuff is good. I don't do nearly as much as I did once upon a time, in part because I don't like getting on a plane. I don't like getting in a car and driving places. I would rather be here with the dogs. I'd rather be hanging out at Casablanca with my grandchildren. It's a fear thing, right? So many of the companies have been spanked by the Department of Justice for kind of playing fast and loose. And so they're playing defense. And the people who suffer for that are the docs who really, really want to know the real life, real world stuff.
Right.
You know, and you know, you and I are fortunate. If we wish to, we have access to people who can give us answers. I just used a new extended depth of focus implant, started using it really, really early on, and was able to speak with the chief scientist on that whole project. And that was fascinating. I mean, I was kind of gawking at all the data that's available. And that's all well and good, but what everybody else in the community wanted to know was not that from the can, right off the label stuff. What they've asked me is, you know, how does it go in? How are patients reacting post-op? What is the challenge? Is there a challenge? Is there better lens? Is not? And in the earlier times in our career, we were much, much freer to be able to say that. I agree with your experience. I wonder how we might get back to that. You know,
I'm doing it now. You know why? You be your own boss. We go back to the private practice model. If I don't have to kiss the ring of anyone, and I can be my own boss. Well, then I can just do what I need to do. So I'll tell you my real world experience. I'll give you a great example. Talking about EDOF lenses, extended up the focus lenses. You know, I just had a realization in my own clinic after doing a tremendous volume of these. Pupil size is far more important than they're telling us. If you look at a lens that has a central little optical bump or a special, you know, zone that's 2.2 millimeters, and the patient never gets more than a 3-millimeter pupil, and you aim for plano, that patient's going to end up myopic.
Yes.
But the companies don't tell you this. You find out the hard way. So I had to make a whole video on Cataract Coach of the effective pupil size with various EDOF lenses. I went through all of them, all available EDOF lenses in America. Now, the amazing part is that got like 20,000 ophthalmologists saw that in the first week or two.
Yes.
So that's the amazing power of the internet. But yeah, well, you got to learn the hard way. And the way to do it is to not kiss the ring, to go back to private practice model.
Yeah, I agree with that, Uday. Having the freedom to... having the freedom to explore, I think, is one of the joys of the practice models that we've had.
Right.
What have you been hearing from your friends whose private practices have been rolled up in the private equity model about those kinds of things? Freedom to practice, freedom to choose, freedom to experiment. And I'm a blank slate with this, so this will be knowledge for me. Are they able to do the things that you and I are able to do? If we see a lens that we think is interesting, we can put in a dozen, or are they more constricted because of supply chain things or whatever?
my friends who were prior practice ended up selling out to a big group of private equity have been mostly miserable. Mostly miserable. So you miss a lot of things. Like you and I want to buy this machine. It looks so amazing. Some diagnostic device. Well, not so simple anymore.
Yes.
And I put in a request. Now they have to have some mid-level MBA, you know, from University of Phoenix, which could be a good place. I'm not picking on anyone, but they're going to tell you like, no, here's the cost analysis. You'd have to do X thousand number scans to pick up. No, you can't have it. And he's like, really? That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. If I need it for best pick, like if I had that situation, how would I ever justify what I do now? In surgery, I say, I want to give the same surgery that I want to receive. And if it's my eye, I want the incision to be made with a diamond keratome. So I spent umpteen thousands and I have diamond keratomes. But no, any guy who's a mid-level MBA manager is going to say, nah, use the steel blades. They're cheaper.
Yes. Yes.
Yes, you get a lump sum of cash if you sell the practice. But was it worth it?
I'm interested. So first of all, for you and me, just for your audience's sake, you know, we still own our own practices. We still are in classic private practice. Right. You know, we still don't have bosses. I think it's going to be interesting to see if we're going to start to see a kind of a repatriation of doctors who were either rolled up into big academic institutions or rolled up into private equity. If we're going to start to see an exodus from them back into private practice, there's a tiny little movement in the youngest of the ophthalmologists. You know, people who are coming out of their residencies, people who are in their first, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, taking the leap, hanging up a shingle, or you know, joining a smaller group. Right. Maybe it's just wishful thinking because you know, at some point I'll have to do something with my practice. You know, and for me, I mean, if I just drop the keys on the counter at the end, walk out, and leave my clogs in the middle of the floor like the wrestlers retiring, you know, I'll be fine.
Right.
It would be disappointing if that happened, but I would be fine. But I'm starting to hear whispers that perhaps people are going to return to private practice. Are you hearing anything like that?
Well, if, you know, private equity having the idea that they'll buy up a bunch of practices, bundle them together, buff them up for a little bit, you know, cut costs and try to bump revenue, and then sell them to someone else in a few years, I don't see that panning out. Because who's going to buy it next? Another PE group? I don't know if that's really going to work. And well, so you had a podcast which this relates to all this. You had a podcast of like unnecessary care and a personal experience about this. Mm-hmm. And maybe now are you having groups where they're like trying to drive revenue so hard that they're saying no, you need to like find these things to get more billing. That's not me.
Yeah, I think there's we should be careful not to lump the entire industry under one umbrella, because I think
for sure
there's still kind of a vast array of experiences out there. I agree with you, a significant proportion, maybe more than half of my friends and colleagues whose practices have been bought by private equity are chafing under the oversight.
Yeah.
The practices that are in the first round, that first roll-up where the company is still either run by an ophthalmologist or the ophthalmologist have a little bit more say in the running of the company, they tend not to be as unhappy. They tend to be happier about, in my experience, the infusion of capital. It's the second sale that you alluded to that tends to put more distance between the original ophthalmologists and the people who are now making those decisions. But I like your analogy about the equipment. Our practice, of course, is not only a cataract and refractive practice, but we do an awful lot of dry eye. And we recently added two pieces of equipment that, you know, we didn't necessarily need, but they're making what we do better. We added an eye trace, mm-hmm. and the eye trace is giving me lots and lots of information for second opinions, especially about where the problem may lie if a person's had surgery someplace else. But as they improve their software and as they improve their logarithms, it's giving me some really interesting insights into the dynamics of the tear film on the surface of the eye. There's also an instrument called the BOSA, the Bruder Ocular Surface Analyzer, which Bruder and one of their family of companies has. And that is giving us an opportunity to automate a lot of the things that we do again and again and again, the initial tear breakup time, the meniscus height, things like that. Mm-hmm. I didn't need either one of them. Both of them may eventually carry their own weight. But instantly by doing that, everybody in my practice, all the optometrists who work with me, all the technicians who are feeding information to me, and I, we all became better at our job.
Right. And
it's the outcomes that we're getting, we're already seeing a really nice improvement. I would say that neither machine is carrying its weight right now from a financial standpoint, and they may never do so when we're thinking about dry eye. I think the iTrace may replace all the rest of my topographers as they continue to enhance their logarithms. But the purpose was strictly clinical. The purpose was strictly to make my eye better.
Well, there's a spectrum there. On one end of the spectrum is you treat purely from the heart and the brain. And the other end of the spectrum is you treat from the wallet. And you mostly want to be on the treating from the heart and from the brain part of the spectrum.
It certainly makes it easier to go home at the end of the day, doesn't it? Makes it easier to leave the office and feel like you did the job that you were put there to do.
For sure. I'm not the best businessman, that's for sure. But I'll tell you this, 100% of patients I see, I give them the same treatment that I'd want for my own body, my own eyes, 100%.
Yeah. Yep. And, you know, it's especially, you know, with dry eye, it's easy for me. I mean, I've had a bitter dry eye since I was in my mid-20s. And I literally stood in the parking lot in 2003 waiting for Joe Bankovich to show up. He was the manager, the Allergan manager in our territory. I'm waiting for Joe to show up and open up his trunk and take out the first samples of Restasis because I was dying to take it. I've been on an immunomodulator since 2003. And my dry eye, just like everybody else's, has gotten worse. And so I had about 40% of unresolved symptoms. I just started on perfluoral hexaloctane, Mibo, when it was approved. So I empathize with my patients, to a great degree.
For sure.
That's one of the things that it's been great to have permission to do. To be able to do that. So you said you're not a great businessman. Let's talk a little bit about that, because my practice, and just quickly to reference private equity again, one of our friends, I won't name names because I don't want to get them in trouble with their private equity owners, but one of my friends said to me that my practice has more in common with Vance Thompson's practice, even though the scale is vastly different than I have with anybody else, because my practice is based on culture. Right. And he said that, you know, when you sell your practice to private equity, or if you join a big institution like the Mayo Clinic, the Cedars-Sinai, Cleveland Clinic, places like that, there's only one culture and it ain't going to be yours. And to throw a big compliment to Vance. Vance and I started our practices at pretty much exactly the same time, and same basic theory, same basic structure, same basic philosophy. Vance did two things better than I did. Vance started his practice from his established practice, and I went out on my own and did it. And so Vance had an ongoing cash flow to do things. And Vance was smart enough not to do it under the umbrella of two very large, very aggressive accountable care organizations. And so I have a little one office practice that is, you know, highly, highly focused on the customer and patient experience.
Right.
Vance's emphasis is on the customer and the patient experience. And like my practice, we both start off putting our emphasis on making sure that the people who work for us are having a good experience working for us. Vance, of course, now has, I don't know, 15 offices and 5 surgery centers and umpteen partners. So, you know, Vance, if you ever listen to this, you did it better, brother. But
we had him on the podcast previously. So yeah, very fantastic episode. Go back and listen to it, people.
I did. I listened to that one. So there's a culture. Right. And there's a culture that we all try to foster. And I'm interested, as your practice has evolved over the last 20 years, has your culture evolved? Is there have there been mileposts along the way that you feel you reached and maybe you adjusted, pivoted, or enhanced? What's your experience been with that?
Yeah, you know, I think the only constant that I've had is change. And so I think there have been periodic changes. Some are larger, some are smaller. Probably a big change was the first 6 years or so in my practice, I did everything that walked in the door. I had fantastic residency training. And so I felt comfortable doing strabismus surgery and ptosis surgery and glaucoma and cataract and cornea and you name it. I did diabetic, you know, PRP, panoramic photocoagulation. I could do anything. I did 1,000 diabetic lasers in residency, 1,000. So I thought I was great. But then I realized, okay, what do I really love in ophthalmology? So then I made a shift. I said, you know what? I want to just do an anterior segment. I want to just do cataract and refractive. And then at some point I switched to a practice where I essentially only see patients for cataract or refractive surgery. And so that was a big culture change, because now instead of having continuity with patients, like you have a patient with a chronic disease, let's say ARMD or glaucoma, and you're seeing them every few months or every 6 months forever. This is where it's like, okay, they come in, they do a refractive procedure or they do a cataract surgery. And once they're great, they're good to go, you're done. And so you don't get to see the patient. So there's a big culture or office shift, let's say, for that, because now you've got a different type of practice. It's not having that continuity.
So yeah, that's a big shift. I also had a great comprehensive residency. I trained at NYU, and Mark Steele and I actually still hold records for the most lasers done at as senior residents at NYU. We may or may not have shifted lasers that might have gone to the fellows toward ourselves, maybe. In my early years, I did all that too, and it's interesting that the arc of what we've done has been so parallel as time has gone on.
Right.
I started to drop the things that I really didn't enjoy. I was really good at doing lid surgery, but I didn't like it, and so I handed that off, and you know, did PRPs, and then I realized that boy, oh boy, there's this big retina group right down the street.
Right.
You know, they do a great job with that stuff, and I don't have to do that. And thank heavens I had made that decision before anti-VEGFs came in. I mean, you know, I have no interest in doing that. You know, doing lasers, you know, way back when before we had anti-VEGFs, and you're doing lasers for subretinal neovascularization. The only thing that's in question is how big will the blind spot be?
Right. Yeah.
God bless retinal doctors, you know, that they're willing to do that. But it's interesting, the scope of practice for me, my scope of practice has become smaller and smaller and smaller over the years as I do more and more of less and less. But it's interesting, in my community, I'm far from the busiest cataract surgeon in my community. There are people who were much more driven to get their practices to be more like yours. And we've got a guy in town, Bill Wiley, who's just an absolutely fantastic cataract surgeon. And Bill does, you know, 3 times as many cataracts as I do, but does a just an epically wonderful job. And so I'm happy he's in town. But for some of the other things, one of the experiences that I'm having, which it sounds like you're not having so much, is even though the big organizations have been getting bigger, things are harder to achieve for the patients. It's harder for the patients to get in. I had my first blowout fracture coming in seeking surgery in 10 years, 2 weeks ago. I haven't done an orbital case in 30 years. And at Bellevue, of course, I mean, that was a weekly experience, right? At Bellevue, we used to call, this is very, not very polite, but we used to call the trauma victims targets. And in New York City, there are only two kinds of people, targets and people who hit targets. And at Bellevue, you know, the ER was the target range. And I saw a blowout fracture every single night that I was on call. But why is that patient coming to me? You know, why was that patient in to see me? We had a patient who has a perichiasmal tumor, and they're already in one of the big organizations. And that patient was coming to me for the consultation. Right. You've got 40 ophthalmologists in the organization. Why is that patient coming to me? And the reality was that they couldn't get through to get in with the big organization.
Wow.
And so again, to kind of drift back to the private practice model, if you're in an office where the people who are answering the phone are around the corner in the office from the people who are seeing the patients, the private practice model still works awfully well.
It works great.
The patient gets in, right? Now, should they be seeing me with those problems? Probably not. You know, I'm probably not the guy. I still remember most of that. And, you know, we try very hard to get them to the appropriate person at the academic centers. But it's an interesting take that I don't think is talked about enough.
Right. I had a patient recently, just this week, where the patient had seen, he was in a group that he had found, he had a doctor he liked, an ophthalmologist he liked. That group was sold to another big group. That other doctor, his favorite doctor retired. He says, then they replaced him, that his favorite doctor, with another one and then another one. And he just says, they just keep going, like a revolving door of young doctors starting that practice. Then he says, he tried to call all sorts of other big centers around me. And he says, it took forever to get in. He says, I called your clinic. He says, you offered me an appointment within a week or two. And he says, then I came here today. He says, I get checked in right away. He says, I didn't wait not even 5 minutes in your waiting room. And now the next thing you know, I'm in the exam room. He says, that kind of experience, he says, he hasn't had in years.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a wonder that we're not hearing more about that. And it's a wonder that we're not hearing more from patients about that. I don't know how to affect that, you know, for all the platforms that I've been granted and for all the opportunities that I've been given to share things. I don't know how to change that. I'm really at a loss to know how we can move that needle. You know, medicine is the ultimate consumer service business, right? You know, we are charged with, we're given this privilege to take care of folks when they're at their most vulnerable.
Right.
And it's something that really is a privilege as much as it is a profession. But see that my better 95% is heading out.
No, I think you're right. I think that's an important thing. Patients are really seeking our services. And the nice part now with the private practice, like I said, you can specialize in something like category refractive. And we go from just being competent, which I'm competent to do ptosis surgery, blepharoplasty. I'm competent to do, but I'm not an artist at it. But cataract and refractive, I'm an artist. I love it. That's my passion. As you said, I know more and more about a narrow topic.
Yes. Yes. Boy.
So when a patient sees me for cataract surgery or refractive surgery, you are getting like beyond competence. You're getting artistry. And the patients can feel that, and they really benefit from it. And so similarly, let me not do any PRP. Let me get any retina patient and send it to a colleague who is an artist at retina.
Tell me, what is it in your background? Because, you know, I've listened to you from podiums. I've sat next to you at dinner. I've, you know, gone for long walks and we've just shot the breeze. What is it in your background that you think allowed you to have an early and easy rapport with patients? What is it in your background? What did you learn? How did you learn to be the server on the service continuum? Because that's what we are. I mean, we're on the serving side of the relationship. What in your background, what in your experiences helped you to become so good at that?
Well, it's going back to kindergarten. We learned the golden rule in kindergarten. But if you don't know the golden rule, it's do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So I want to give the same level of care that I want to receive. And that starts off for patients of just really understanding them and just being kind. And, you know, elementary school kids are really cruel. And where I grew up, to have a weird name and a tan was really tough. And so I've never been the popular kid. I mean, even now, there are these little groups in ophthalmology of these, quote, you know, leaders in ophthalmology. Well, they don't want me to be in their group. So I just got to do things my own way. But I want to be able to, like, be more open about this and have a patient come in, accept that they're in a vulnerable state. They're scared out of their mind. You want to go do a surgery on their eyeball? So just to, hey, you know what? I'm here for you. I will give you my absolute best, like absolute. And so, again, it's kindergarten. That's all it is. Yeah,
you came to it a little earlier than I did. How can I put this in
a form? You're easier. When was the last time someone said, can you spell your name?
Yeah, right.
If I say my name, sometimes they'll say, did you sneeze? Bless you. I'm like, no, that's my name.
Yeah, so interestingly, nobody ever spells my name correctly. You know, my name is there's so many different ways to spell it.
How it's common. You spell White?
Yeah, but the first name.
Okay.
Yeah. So my experience was interesting. I grew up in a hyper competitive family, and I mean, to the point, I have three siblings, and we were so competitive that we would compete to be the one to put the first mark in a new peanut butter jar. And we would literally draw blood as we were all going for it for the same time. So there was a huge drive to develop your personality, to develop a competitive drive. And my dad, who was a brilliant manager, absolutely brilliant, kind of a business process a savant, but also a great manager of people. He, at least for my brother and I, he insisted that we become caddies. And we're both decent golfers. And then my brother's an excellent golfer. He's plus two. It's crazy. But he insisted that we become caddies. And a part of the reason that he did it was, you know, he wanted us out of the house. And, you know, he wanted us to be off the dole as soon as we could. But the other reason was that he realized that for high achievers, it was important to realize that there are times when it's not even a little bit about you. And when you're caddying, your entire, you know, 4 or 5, 6 hour experience is about making sure that your golfer or the golfers that you're caring for are having a good day.
Right.
Doesn't matter what kind of a day you're having. It only matters what kind of a day they're having. And so that was where it was ingrained in me. And I wrote an essay one time, and I talked about it being about how medicine is the ultimate consumer service business. And, you know, what should we do to inculcate that philosophy in our residents and young doctors, not only in ophthalmology, but all around. And I looked around and I thought about, you know, what are the other jobs that are like that, where it's high pressure and maybe it's high volume, but you're not the person who's at the center of it. And, you know, if you think about it, certainly a caddy, a shoe salesperson, right? How much more, you know, focused are you on something which maybe, you know, you're not really totally comfortable with than helping someone buy a pair of shoes, right? You're right there. You're dealing with their feet. And, you know, it's a very personal thing. And then the other one, the high volume, high pressure thing. Is there anybody who has to be more engaged with more people where it's not about them than the person who's waiting on tables in a greasy spoon breakfast place?
Yeah, I guess.
And, you know, it'll never happen, but, you know, it's in my essay, just to you know, poke people. I said, you know, I think that every single internship should have a 3-month fellowship where people either carry a bag, tote a bag, you know, help people buy shoes or wait tables, because it's not about you. It's about the person who is, you know, getting 2 eggs over easy hash browns and maybe some bacon. It's about the person who's trying to decide between, you know, am I getting Bass loafers or am I getting Sperry loafers? Or, and then, you know, in the golf course, you know, it doesn't matter what you would hit from 150 yards. It's what your golfer would hit from 150 yards right. And have the best opportunity to get it on the green.
Right.
So I had a series of epiphanies in what was otherwise a very, very easy youth in comparison with what you've alluded to a couple of times. I mean, I've only been other that I could think of twice in my life. And I'll share that in a second, but going through thinking about how am I going to learn how to be someone who is there to serve somebody else, and for me it was being a caddy.
Right, that makes a ton of sense. I mean, those, it's funny, a little side story. I had a patient of mine tell me, very hoity-toity, but patient who has, you know, a full house staff at home. He says, "Doctor, he was so happy after a cataract surgery, +3 hypo, made a plano OU with monofocal lenses. That's all I did."
Yep.
He says, "Doctor, of all my service personnel, you and my chef are my two favorites." And I was like, "Thank you. That must be one heck of a chef."
Oh, that's great. That's great.
What do you think the future of private practice is going to be? What's going to happen to all of this?
So I don't think that anything's going to happen to you and me. I don't think that we're going to be driven out only because we're far enough along in our practices. I think there's in order for things to truly change, I think we need to see an exodus from the larger organizations of some of the younger people. And I think we need to get some kind of support from patient organizations to change some of the reimbursement policies that there are. I mean, the difference between what you and I get paid for what we do in comparison with the large accountable care organizations in your world, UCLA, Cedars-Sinai, places like that, is really what's been driving people into the bigger groups. Mm-hmm. They don't get $569 for a cataract. They get 160% of that because of the adjustments, because they're an ACO. Same thing in the operating rooms. Your operating room, your surgery center gets from Medicare $969. And it's the same $969 or $989 that we get in Cleveland, although your expenses are much higher. But for a Medicare patient, UCLA is getting $1,700. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is some of that justified because of the difference in what they're doing in the community? Perhaps. But many of those organizations, while crying poor, are sitting on hundreds of millions of dollars of what they call revenue in excess of expenses. The rest of us call that profit.
Yeah.
But there has been such a mega trend that followed the Affordable Care Act's passing, that has made it hard from a financial standpoint to be in private practice. Again, you and I are far enough along the line, we're probably going to be able to make it through without having a boss. But what it's going to take to rejuvenate that is young people saying, "Listen, I want my boss to be the person who's sitting in the chair in front of me. Mm-hmm. I want my boss to be the person who's sitting under the microscope in the operating room."
Right.
In primary care, the movement to concierge care, direct pay, is a movement which has legs. I think it's harder to do for people like you and me. There's a very small group in the United States who have been doing nothing but cash pay. And the reason it hasn't really taken off is because, you know, it doesn't matter how big your city is, there's a very small market segment that's going to come in and do nothing but out-of-pocket pay. Even for laser vision correction. I mean, there are some very, very famous pioneers in laser vision correction surgery who were fellowship trained corneal docs, who were fabulous corneal docs, who in the 1990s withdrew from all plans and did nothing but laser vision correction. Mm-hmm. And almost all of them returned to what you and I would think of as traditional cataract and refractive practices, where yes, they have the cash pay option, but it's an option, not the only way to do it. There's only a handful of people who do that. I think the in the specialties, in the surgical specialties like yours and mine, non-cosmetic, it's a challenge. And I try to be optimistic that there will be a next wave of private practitioners who will go out and put the patient first, who will go out and grind like you and I did.
Right.
And, you know, hopefully reap the benefits of the grind, because, you know, your life and my life, you know, our lives are pretty good right now. We worked awfully hard when we were young men. We had a lot of people whose footsteps we walked in, right? You know, neither one of us was born on third base. You know, I beat out an infield single and maybe I stole second, and then, you know, somebody sacrificed me to third, and that's how I ended up on third base. I don't know how they're going to, how the younger people are going to be able to do it, Uday. I know that anytime I'm asked, I've had the privilege of mentoring some younger ophthalmologists in their 30s and 40s as they've asked these questions. And anytime I'm asked, I extol the virtues of only working for that person who sits in front of you. And
I had a podcast where I learned something very important. A young ophthalmologist, Jeffrey Tran, T-R-A-N, is one of my podcasts, maybe, you know, 20 to 30 episodes back. Early 30s, mid 30s, 35 years old, decided that his first job or second job wasn't really the fit for him, decided to go solo. And his revelation, which struck me, and I still remember, is he says, when was the last time you ever heard of an ophthalmologist who started a private practice and then it failed and he or she had to shut it down? I said, I've never heard of that. He says, right. He says, so private practice has a virtually 100% guarantee you will succeed. It won't be easy. It'll take time. But he says, you can certainly do it. And yeah, he is making a go of it. And his podcast is fantastic. If you're a young ophthalmologist, you better go back and look up that episode and listen to it. But you can for sure do it. The advice I'd give to my own, let's say, kids, if they go into medicine and they do private practice, be your own boss. It will take time to build momentum. You cannot build momentum overnight, but it'll be one of the best things you ever did. And I think the young generation is smarter than us. They have a much more interest, bigger interest in valuing work-life balance and spending time with their families and doing it better than I did or better than we did. And so I encourage them, you can do it. And I think there's going to definitely be a role for it. And I'd bet on it.
I'm a fan of that philosophy. And I am saying the same thing to everybody. Look, you get to choose how your life goes, right? Remember when you were on the road all the time, and then you looked at that and you said, hey, listen, what I really like is I really like doing ophthalmology, not talking about ophthalmology, and you just turned off the spigot. You know, when I was 35, Beth said to me, hey, listen, I'm all about, you know, you being successful and you defining what success is. And if you want to be expert who travels and things like that, and that's how you'll define success, great, I'll back you 100%. But if you're just doing it because it looks like it's kind of fun, then I'd rather you come home for dinner. And so I didn't do anything for 10, 12 years other than go to work and be a working ophthalmologist. You have that choice, though. You can make those decisions based on what's important to you as a human,
right?
Not necessarily what's important to you as an employee or a professor or whatever. I hope we're right, Uday. I really hope that we're right. You and I and many of our peers have had a great run. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know what the end game looks like. I really, really don't. I don't know what I'm going to retire to or when that's going to happen. I don't know what the financial aspects are going to be at the end game. But all along the way, for 34 years, having the opportunity to put the person who sits in front of me first.
Right.
Just like the guy who is a 25 handicap, I'm toting his bag on a Saturday morning. You know, I was able to put him
first. Yeah.
The lessons that you learned in kindergarten, the lessons that I learned from my dad and on the golf course about how we're supposed to treat people for whom we are working. And at the end of the day, when I'm sitting down in the captain's chair in the operating room, you know, snuggling up to the microscope, yeah, the person who's really the boss is the person who's on the table there. That's the person for whom I'm working. I'm very hopeful that our memories will become a legacy that others will take up, that they'll carry the mantle of private practice surgery.
They'll take it to the next level.
Yeah.
My point was, if I needed to have a shoulder surgery, I'd seek out an orthopedic surgeon who I thought specialized in shoulders, didn't do everything, he focused on this one issue, and was an artist at this thing, and had a private practice where I could be put first. I wouldn't go to a huge academic place because I know from ophthalmology side, no matter what the academic sign on the door says, you're getting some like person who agreed to work for cheap if they're young, and you may not get the care you're dreaming of, and the patient experience is just not great. So I'd choose a private practice for orthopedics. So why wouldn't people choose it for ophthalmology? You know what? They will. And they'll choose it more and more in the future.
I hope so. And I hope that young ophthalmologists who are coming out of their residency programs, coming out of their fellowships, or, you know, maybe coming out of a big organization will listen to Dr. Tran's podcast with you.
Right.
And we'll maybe take a listen to what you and I have talked about and just give it a serious thought. Private practice from a medical standpoint has always been how people get the best experience when they're getting care. They get outcomes which are certainly no less than any other circumstance.
Right.
It can be hard for us, right? When I started Sky Vision, I took an 80% pay cut and I didn't get a raise for 7 or 8 years. Right. But it was still great to go to work. And because again, I was there for the person who was sitting in front of me. And that's why we went into medicine. That's the, we were good at science, but yeah, that's why we went into medicine. Plus, right. You know, at the end of the day, when you're in the office, you know, you're the guy who's doing most of the talking. And I think I mentioned all the way in the beginning that I love the sound of my own voice. And so I get to talk to people all day long.
Right. No, it's fantastic. Listen, I wouldn't change a thing. I'm so happy I've kind of had the career path I've had. And I'll tell young ophthalmologists, listen, your first job, it's like your first girlfriend or boyfriend. They can be great and all for the time, but may not be the one you're with forever, and that's okay. If you decide later in life, you can still do private practice.
Yeah, and we learn from all of them, right? We learn from all of those experiences. The first big practice that I was in, even though I left under slightly trying circumstances, on balance, it was a great learning experience. And the senior partner was a great ophthalmologist from whom I learned an awful lot, not only from a business standpoint, but also from an ophthalmology standpoint. And I don't regret a minute that I was there because of all the learning and his generosity as a teacher. And, you know, there are different versions of private practice. My path just ended up being a smaller group where at the moment I'm, you know, like you, I'm the only cutter.
Right. And the nice part, too, is, like I said, we're our own bosses. Earlier this year, I took off a bunch of time to travel. This year, I'm actually going to give cataract coach lectures in 21 countries.
21 countries?
This year alone, in 2024 alone.
Wow.
So So I really, but I can do that because I can do what I want.
Yes.
And yes. So, no, I encourage our young people. Keep this in mind. You can do this. I promise. I assure you, I am not that special. So.
After you said you can do whatever you want, I missed that part.
I said, I'm not that special. If I can do it, you can do it. You can do it better than I can do it.
I think that's, and I'm excited to see that. I'm excited to be able to watch what that next generation is going to do from the platform that our colleagues and you and I have done. Because, yeah, for sure, man, they're smarter. they have their stuff together. Yeah, that's all of that for sure. 21 countries, holy smokes, that's quite a year.
Because I want to.
Yeah.
And so to me, it's like it's a pleasure. So it's not really. It's
well, you've earned the privilege of doing that, because it's not like you didn't work hard to get here, right?
No, of course. Yeah, listen. Some people say it's luck, but I say, yeah, the harder I work, the luckier I get. It's funny how that is.
Yes. Well, listen, man, I really am so thrilled to get a chance to chat with you. And, you know, hopefully you've had as much fun as I have.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. Sasha apologizes for interrupting, but she desperately needed to tell us what was outside the window.
We love dogs. Don't worry about it. Thank you again, Daryl. I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we've got a new Cattle Coach podcast every Sunday. Amazon, Apple, Spotify, Google, anywhere you find your podcast, you find the Cattle Coach podcast. Also, remember, we still have a new Cattle Coach video every single day. More than 2,200 videos, and I promise I won't miss a day. So until next time, we'll catch you later.